and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with an assessment of the money race between Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton, in which in July alone, Clinton raised $140 million compared to $78 million for Trump, who got 64% of his money from donations under $200, while 36% of Clinton's money came from small donors. Rebecca Ballhaus, a reporter in the Wall Street Journal's Washington, D.C. bureau, where she writes about national politics and campaign finance, joins us to discuss how far ahead in fundraising and media buying the Clinton campaign is and whether Trump can catch up. Then we'll look into the latest scandal, whether manufactured or real, that the Republicans hope will dog Hillary Clinton all the way until the November 8th election. And that is the Clinton Foundation, about which Donald J. Trump announced today in a statement, quote, "It is clear that the Clinton Foundation is the most corrupt enterprise in political history." John Wunderlich, the executive director of the Sunlight Foundation, one of the foremost authorities on transparency policy, joins us to offer some proportionality and perspective to claims of alleged Clintonian corruption in an election where, in closed-door enclaves with Republican donors, the Koch brothers raise billions to be spent in secret, while Trump himself refuses to even release his own tax returns. Then finally, we will analyze the rebooted Trump campaign now headed by Stephen Bannon, the chairman of Breitbart Media, who is the champion of the alt-right, an assemblage of anti-immigrant, anti-Muslim, ethno-nationalist provocateurs who see the GOP as appeasers and Fox News as tame. Sarah Posner, an investigative journalist, author, and expert on the intersection of religion and politics, joins us to discuss her article at Mother Jones, how Donald Trump's new campaign chief created an online haven for white nationalists, and how Bannon takes credit for fomenting this populist nationalist movement long before Trump turned it into a voting bloc or a future audience for Trump TV. And joining us now is Rebecca Ballhaus, who's a reporter in the Wall Street Journal's Washington, D.C. bureau, where she writes about national politics and campaign finance. She also contributes to the Daily Capital Journal Daybreak newsletter. Welcome to Background Briefing, Rebecca Ballhaus.
Thanks so much for having me.
And the Federal Elections Commission's figures for July for Trump and Hillary Clinton's a haul of money in this obviously very expensive election year. My understanding is what the figures were, Trump raised $37 million and Hillary Clinton $52 million. But your figures, I think, are more accurate, are they not? They're broader in terms of, because nowadays there are all kinds of ways that candidates raise money, most of it accessible, but some of it secret.
Right. So, yeah, we got on Saturday evening a full picture of all of the fundraising by all of the campaigns and their various allied entities. So what we saw was that Hillary Clinton's campaign raised $63 million in July, and that was in addition to $26 million raised for two joint funds that she has with the Democratic Party. She also raised $10 million in a friendly super PAC called Priorities USA Action, and she finished the month with, between all these separate accounts, $140 million on hand. Trump, meanwhile, raised $36 million directly for his campaign in July, and that was on top of $44 million for his joint funds with the RNC, and his super PACs raised about $4 million in July. So their total cash on hand number at the end of the month was $78 million, so a little over half of Hillary's.
Well, what I found extraordinary about the information that you're providing here, Rebecca Ballhaus, in your Wall Street Journal articles, is that the Trump campaign improved its fundraising among smaller donors. About 64% of Trump's campaign July haul came from donations of less than $200. By comparison, about 36 of Mrs. Clinton's funds came from small donations. So I guess Trump's is a real populist campaign.
Right. I mean, I think that's absolutely true, that I think he has done much better among smaller donors than Clinton has. Clinton also, you know, Bernie Sanders did much better among small Democratic donors than she did. So that's an area where she struggled. But something else we saw that was interesting in Trump's reports was that, yes, he did very well among small donors, but he also significantly ramped up his spending on digital fundraising efforts. And, you know, fundraising among small donors can be a great way to bring in money, but it's also, depending on what tactic you use, not always the most efficient means of raising money. So if you have to spend a lot of money to raise a lot of money, that's not always the best way of doing it. And we don't know exactly which practices he was paying for, but we saw that his payments to hit one firm that did website and other digital services for him went up more than sixfold in July over June. And meanwhile, he wasn't really spending money on typical things that candidates spend on at this stage in the race, like ads and building up your staff and field organization.
But he's spending a lot of money on hats, right?
Right. That continues to be true.
What kind of figures? I mean, these are the Make America Great Again hats, right?
Right. So I think his total number for July on hats and other campaign merchandise was about $1.8 million, and that's out of $18 million that he spent.
So what about the dark money vehicles, these 501c4s, where they're not required under this rubric of social welfare, they're not required to release their donors, and it's become in many ways a favorite vehicle of big corporate donors who don't want to, you know, the assumption would be that if you're a public corporation and half your customers are Democrats and half of them are Republicans, you don't want to necessarily tip your hand about who you're giving money to. So... Mm-hmm. This is probably the most pernicious aspect of this flood of money that's pouring into our politics. But how do you account for that, or is there an accounting for that in the figures that you've given us?
Well, that's something that I think it has been interesting, actually, because earlier in the cycle we saw candidates like Jeb Bush and Marco Rubio. They got super PACs and leadership PACs, and they had their campaigns, and then they would also get these dark money vehicles that you described, 501c4s, that oftentimes had similar names to their super PACs. They had to observe similar rules, like super PACs can raise money without coordination caps, but can't coordinate with the campaigns on strategy. And so we didn't know who was giving to these vehicles, and they were spending, in at least Marco Rubio's case, I think more than $10 million on ads on his behalf. But Trump and Clinton don't really seem to have the same kind of operations. And, I mean, maybe in Trump's case, he got such a late start fundraising that his super PAC operation is really still struggling to get off the ground, I would say. So I don't think he's quite there yet in terms of a 501c4. And Clinton has sort of more focused her efforts, or rather Clinton and her allies have really more focused her efforts on the super PAC and her campaign and her joint fundraising vehicles with the DNC, rather than really employing one of these dark money organizations, as you describe them.
And again, I'm speaking with Rebecca Ballhouse, who's a reporter in the Wall Street Journal's Washington, D.C. Bureau, where she writes about national politics and campaign finance. She also contributes to a daily Capital Journal Daybreak newsletter. So let's talk about the announcement today by the Clinton campaign that they're essentially spending, I think, about $80 million on ad buys all the way through to the election in November. And that's considerably more than Donald Trump. So is that an accurate figure?
I haven't seen that exact figure. I know she spent about $60 million in the last 2 months. That's the latest number I've seen.
Uh-huh. But this is apparently a new buy that that goes all the way through the election. So, so far, what do we know about Donald Trump's, you mentioned the digital expenses for digital online fundraising, but what kind of money is he spending and on what? As far as I know, there's only been one commercial that was produced, and then I believe in the meeting that took place a week ago on the weekend with the inner circle of Trump's, that Roger Ailes sort of nixed it, thought it wasn't particularly good. Where does his ad production and buying stand, do you know?
So he just, over the weekend, I believe, launched his first real ad campaign of the general election. And he said that he was spending $4.8 million in four states on airing this one ad, and I think it was over the next 10 days or so. But it's pretty remarkable that we are nearing the end of August, and this is the first ad campaign he's put out since becoming the party's nominee, or even since, you know, effectively clinching the nomination in May, while Clinton, as I said, has spent more than $60 million on ads in the last few months. Now, his campaign has said that they have less of a need than typical campaigns to rely on paid media because of Trump's ability to get on these networks. You know, networks, I think, have in many cases toned down their coverage. They no longer really carry his full rallies live. I think you see less of an imbalance between the amount of network time devoted to him and to Clinton. During the primary, of course, he sort of called into these networks all the time, especially on the Sunday shows, and he just really was able to dominate the coverage in a way that his rivals were not. But I think we've seen that even out a little bit, and so I think that's probably why Trump is feeling the need to finally get on air now. But I know a lot of his donors and supporters were concerned that he was taking so long, because it's not like he doesn't have the money to air these ads. He just doesn't seem to be spending it all.
Well, the conventional wisdom, surely, Rebecca Ballhouse, is that at this month in the campaign is when you frame yourself and frame your opponent. And if Hillary Clinton has spent $60 million, most of which, from what I've seen, is basically framing her opponent and using his words against him, maybe she's made some ads to talk about what she's going to do, but I haven't seen them. But would that indicate that she's way ahead of the game in many ways? The earlier you frame somebody, the more that sort of sinks in as the kind of public's consciousness about who that person is. Is that a correct analysis?
You're right. I think that certainly doesn't hurt her. And I think you've seen in the polls in the last couple of weeks in particular that she's really moving ahead in a way that it's unusual to have such a large gap at this stage in the race. She's leading in every swing state. She has a big lead nationally as well. So, you know, initially, I think the Trump campaign's line was, well, Hillary Clinton has spent $1 million on ads, but yet it's a pretty tight race in the polls. And I think that's no longer the case.
So in terms of this sort of change in the campaign, which is absolutely clear that things have changed, and I believe this meeting that I referred to took place over the, not this last weekend, but the weekend before last, with Roger Ailes and many of these new people, Stephen Bannon and Kellyanne, who is seems to be running the campaign, although we don't know about Roger Ailes' influence. And now, of course, we learned today that Sean Hannity is offering his services. So what is your understanding about this shift? I first detected it with the speech that he made in Milwaukee, which is extremely well-written, well-crafted, and very smart speech compared to, you know, streams of insults. It was, you know, I thought a very clever speech. I don't know that it had a lot of impact. And I don't know that by reaching out to African-American voters, he's having much success. But there's a very detectable change. So what do you understand? What's your understanding of the inside maneuvering going on here, where this candidate has made some abrupt changes very quickly and very recently? And even now there's reports that he met with some Latino Republicans who have basically tempered his message about the wall and about deporting 11 million people in this country?
I mean, I think that's really hard to say. I think with a typical candidate, it's easier to sort of sense changes and predict what might happen in the future. And that's not something we've ever really seen happen with Trump. I mean, I think we've done several stories over the course of the last couple of months about Trump looking like he's about to pivot and become more presidential and adopting a shift in tone, and that's never lasted more than maybe a week or so. So last week we saw him add these two new advisors, say this wasn't a staff shakeup, but rather just adding new people on and building out his operation. 2 days later, Paul Manafort, his campaign chairman, resigned, which effectively showed that none of that was true. And that became the news of the day rather than any kind of story about Trump pivoting or staying more on message or whatever the message was that he was trying to get out. So I think Trump has shown a real inability to keep one message going for more than a couple of days without having some big campaign change or some inflammatory statement take over the news cycle. So maybe that will happen going forward. Maybe these new advisors will show a new ability to be able to make him stay on message, but that's not something we have seen at all so far this campaign.
So just turning to the Clinton Foundation, which of course is going to become a major issue for the Republicans, and I think it'll be a major theme if indeed Donald Trump does make a bunch of attack ads, I'm sure they'll be about the Clinton Foundation. The impression you get from the talking heads on cable TV, the surrogates for Trump, is that they're quite gleeful about this. They think this is really going to have some legs and do some damage. What's your reading on it so far, Rebecca?
Well, I think I think you saw the foundation really trying to tamp down some of this criticism with their announcement today and over the weekend that if Hillary Clinton were elected president, they would stop accepting money from corporations and from foreign governments. But at the same time, the foundation has spent the last at least 2 years saying that the fact that the foundation was accepting that kind of money didn't pose any kind of conflict for Hillary Clinton while she was Secretary of State or while she was running for president. So I think that that sort of those two messages you're getting conflict a little bit with each other. And we've seen these emails that have been released in the last couple of weeks from this conservative group Judicial Watch have, I think, really provided some new fodder for Republicans who have been criticizing the foundation, because we see foundation officials writing to top aides of Hillary Clinton at the State Department looking for what seems like favors for donors to the foundation. Today we saw this email where a Clinton Foundation official is looking to set up a meeting between the Crown Prince of Bahrain, who was also a donor to the Clinton Foundation, and Hillary Clinton while she was Secretary of State. Last week's emails, or earlier this month, we saw emails that showed this Clinton Foundation official trying to set up a meeting between a donor to the foundation and an official at the State Department. So there's a lot of overlap, and I think these emails really do provide fodder for Republicans who are criticizing Hillary Clinton for having set up this operation where Clinton foundations felt that they could seek access at the State Department.
Well, obviously, some of the people who gave money to the Clinton Foundation could be considered unsavory. The Kingdom of Saudi Arabia itself could be considered unsavory for a number of reasons, which we could spend a week talking about. But nevertheless, it's considered a close ally. But the Clinton Foundation did take more than $10 million from the Saudis, pretty much high up in the Al Saud family. They also took money from the son-in-law of the former Ukrainian president, whose government was manifestly corrupt and was involved in the murder of journalists. And of course, the Lebanese-Nigerian developer, he's been getting a lot of press as well. Why do you think the Clintons are sort of so flat-footed in this? Because probably if you made the case that, look, you know, we're a foundation, a charitable foundation, we're trying to do good, and the important thing is what we spend our money on, about rather than who we get our money for. I mean, in other words, kind of the Robin Hood theory. You know, you take from the rich and give to the poor. Would that, do you think that would fly? And I don't understand why they haven't at least tried that excuse rather than do the usual Clinton double down, you know, denial.
I actually think you have seen that argument from them. I think they say, you know, we're not taking this money and spending it on ourselves. We're not using it to enrich our officials. We're taking this money no matter where it's coming from, and we're putting it to good use. They point to all their, they have a lot of commitments through the Clinton Global Initiative. They've done all this work in Haiti. Their argument is that we're a foundation. We're not a for-profit organization. We're not, you know, making bank off of these foreign countries. We're doing good things with it. So I think that is the argument you see from them. But then again, I think there are all kinds of questions raised when you have these close ties between someone who's running for president and all of these unsavory people. So it's a hard thing to talk your way out of, I think.
So is there going to be a drip, drip, drip from Judicial Watch? Or have they sort of gone through them and found the most incriminating ones? I'm just trying to get
I think their intent is to have it be as much of a drip, drip, drip as possible. I mean, we saw they released one batch earlier this month of, I think, nearly 300 emails. Today we saw nearly 800 emails released. So I think they're likely trying to keep it going for as long as possible.
But just to the trying to understand the Clinton methodology here, and it relates to the server that's caused so much trouble. And as you know, Rebecca Ballhouse, former Secretary of State Colin Powell, has more or less said that Clinton Foundation are misquoting him, and that he didn't send her a note suggesting she should use a private email, and he never suggested a private email server to begin with. But he says, no, I sent her a note at least a year after she'd set up the private server. So that seems to be causing her trouble. I don't know that that seems to be her staff rather than her causing that problem. But in general, she's not been very deft at getting this scandal behind her. And do you think that that lack of deftness in being able to, you know, explain things clearly and put them to rest is going to haunt her with the Clinton Foundation?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I think, as you say, her struggle with the Clinton email situation has been that she hasn't been able to come up with a pithy response or explanation of why she decided to use a private email server. She sort of muddled through her response for months. She finally apologized for it. Then she made some statements about sort of, that seemed to sort of mischaracterize what the FBI had said about her use of a private email server and her explanations about why she decided to do it. So she doesn't seem to be able to put either the email situation or the foundation situation behind her. And I think that's in large part because she's struggled to come up with a one-line thing that she can say that will sort of assuage people's concerns. And in part, I think that is because there is no one-line thing you can say to make people less worried about these conflicts of interest. But she also has sort of said so many different things on the subject that it makes it hard to glean one response.
Well, just in closing, Rebecca Balhaus, will this year break the records? I think, I can't remember what last year, in 2012, was it the $5 or $6 billion election? Maybe it was more, but...
I think each side spent about $1 billion, and so that included super PACs and campaigns and parties in 2012.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that was a total? For the whole elections?
For the presidential.
For the presidential. Oh, okay. Yeah.
Right.
So will this one be bigger this year?
You know, it's hard to say. I think if it was up to Hillary, yes. She had said that she wanted to raise $1 billion by the end of it. But because I think Donald Trump started so late with fundraising, I wonder if it will fall short because I just don't see him catching up to her by the end of the election. But I could be proven wrong.
Right, and he appears to have a different idea about it. He doesn't think business as usual with campaigns is the way to do it. He's bringing
right, and he doesn't think he needs to raise that much
right,
money.
Right, right. Well, Rebecca Balhaus, I thank you so much for joining us. I appreciate your time.
Thanks for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with Rebecca Balhaus, who is a reporter in the Wall Street Journal's Washington, D.C. Bureau, where she writes about national politics and campaign finance. She also contributes to the Daily Capital Journal Daybreak newsletter. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into Donald Trump's announcement today that the Clinton Foundation is the most corrupt enterprise in political history.
It's the money.
We are sick and tired of being promised this and that. We work all day, we sweat and we slave to keep the wealthy fat. They fill our heads with promises and bamboozle us.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is John Wunderlich, who is the Executive Director for the Sunlight Foundation and one of the nation's foremost advocates for open government, one of the foremost authorities on transparency policy from legislation and accountability in Congress to ethics and information policy in the executive branch. He has spoken internationally on technology and transparency and has testified before the Senate Homeland Security and Government Affairs Committee. Welcome to Background Briefing, John Wunderlich.
Pleasure to be with you.
And obviously, the figures have come out now from the campaign, the fundraising in July, where Hillary Clinton, of course, is almost doubling what Donald Trump has raised. And interesting enough, a lot of Trump's money is coming from small donors under 200. 64% of it's coming from small donors under $200, where I think about 36% of Hillary Clinton's money is coming from small donors. So that's in itself an interesting little tidbit, I guess. But in general, the piling on seems to be more on Hillary Clinton and the foundation, the Clinton Foundation. Again, there's a lot of smoke. It's hard to know where the fire is, but that seems to have been the history of the Clintons, whether they are responsible or whether their opponents have generated an atmosphere of scandal. It sort of swirls around them. So what is it about the Clintons that they can't sort of categorically put things to rest, and they fester and swirl around them? And, you know, I mean, I believe the Judicial Watch people are just starting to drip this stuff out. So I suspect we'll be hearing a lot about the Clinton Foundation all the way through to November.
Yeah, maybe for the next 90 days and maybe for the next 4 to 8 years. In terms of your question, I feel like it's a bit of both. I mean, there's certainly a massive amount of bad faith opposition to the Clintons, and there has been, going back 20 or 30 years. And at the same time, there are things that they do occasionally that feed it, and I think this email setup is among those, where one of the reasons that we're having the revelations now is that we're seeing the results of Freedom of Information Act litigation that was begun 2 or 3 or 4 years ago. So maybe it would have been more convenient for Secretary Clinton if the scandal was during her tenure and not during the throes of the presidential campaign. But I think there's certainly an element of just bad faith opposition that she has to deal with as well.
But in terms of the transparency, which is what you work on or what you're trying to get more of, obviously, it would seem from what I understand about the IRS rules with nonprofits, the Clinton Foundation is a 501c3. They have to publish everything, pretty much, whereas a 501c4, which is supposedly for social welfare benefits, is a secret vehicle, and it's being used extensively to hide political donors. So is there not a double standard here? On the one hand, the right is piling on against Hillary Clinton because, you know, they raise money from the Saudis and from some crooked Ukrainian kleptocrat. But on the other hand, we don't know how much money the Koch brothers and other right-wing funders are funneling through these 501c4 dark money vehicles.
Right. Well, so C3s don't have to disclose all of their donors. Some organizations do. My organization, the Sunlight Foundation, all of our donors are listed on our website. But that's typically less of a concern in terms of politics, because 501c3s are not allowed to take positions on elections. Their job cannot be to try to get someone elected. They have to serve a higher public interest. And 501c4s have far less restrictions on their activities in terms of political work or lobbying or that sort of thing. And so that's why we see C4s as effectively ways to create an end run around our campaign finance restrictions. So if you don't want to have to abide by the accountability laws that govern campaigns, then you end up creating C4s or super PACs, and those are really the mechanisms that let people bypass our campaign finance laws.
But obviously, C3s have to operate on the notion that you can educate but not advocate. Although, you know, no question, on both the left and the right, they push the envelope as much as they can. I'm with Pacifica Foundation, which is a left-wing media organization. It's a C3 too, but we don't have too many Republicans on the airwaves, I can assure
right,
you.
Right.
And I get in trouble every time I even interview a Republican. So, but that's not the point I was trying to raise here, John Wunderlich. It was that at least the Clinton Foundation has published a list of its donors, even if they turn out to be quite incriminating. None of the others publish the list, and they have direct influence over elections, do they not, these dark money C4 vehicles?
The dark money vehicles, certainly the secrecy around their donations is a massive concern, and it's a direct concern to do with campaigning and politicking. So, yeah, the C4s present a much more direct political concern. There is still some question around the different Clinton foundations, and so there's the Clinton Foundation, and there are also associated nonprofits that have not yet disclosed their donors, so there's still some question up in the air about it, but if you just compare the Clinton Foundation to any nonprofit or certainly a C4, they're far more open than C4s are, many C4s at least.
And again, I'm speaking with John Wunderlich, who is an executive director for the Sunlight Foundation, one of the nation's foremost advocates for open government, one of the foremost authorities on transparency policy, from legislation and accountability in Congress to ethics and information policy in the executive branch. He has spoken internationally on technology and transparency and has testified before the Senate Homeland Security and Government Affairs Committee. So is it then possible with the Clinton Foundation that there's even more smoking sleaze, smoking guns, or whatever you want to call them? How would you be able to disguise some of these unsavory third world, or particularly post-Soviet dictators that seem to have been very generous to the Clinton Foundation?
I think there are a couple concerns. One of them is that when you're talking about donations that are this big, was anything given in exchange? So the sort of smoking gun question everyone's going to be asking every time there's a new revelation is, was there a quid pro quo? Was someone buying something more than access to a decision or a specific result from the State Department? And based on what we've seen so far, I haven't seen any evidence that there's a firm quid pro quo. But beyond that, there's another question, which is the public service of either the Secretary of State or the, if Hillary Clinton wins, of the president, Is her ability to make decisions objectively going to be hampered at all by having this legacy of large donations coming in from foreign leaders or other wealthy individuals with a foundation that's still in operation? Or even if they were to shut it down, would it present a conflict of interest? And I think that's actually a pretty complicated question and one that's appropriate to be concerned about. We've had presidents run foundations and fundraise for foundations that will run their presidential libraries, but that's a bit different in scope and scale from what we're looking at in terms of the Clinton Foundation and the associated other initiatives.
And the fact that they, in many ways, are sort of like at least they've tried to portray themselves as a kind of Robin Hood organization, where they take money from the rich and give to the poor with AIDS drugs in Africa. They don't seem to have made a successful case of that, have they? I mean, if they would have said up front, you know, look, we raise a lot of money and our job is to raise money for good deeds and good causes, and we're not that much focused on where the money comes from, but we're more focused on what we do with the money, and we do good with the money. Have they made that case? Otherwise, they seem to be sort of twisting in the wind here.
I'm less skeptical about whether the work they do is good. I haven't seen a whole lot of criticism that says these programs are against the public interest or they're vapid or empty or something like that. So that criticism, I think, has been tougher to level at the foundations. And one could question whether it's the most efficient way of going about any specific intervention around health or whatever it is. But the overall benevolence of the initiatives, I think, is generally accepted. The greater questions are whether the network of people that donate to the foundation ended up getting sweetheart deals or special access to the Secretary of State or people associated with them. And I think that's sort of the bigger concern, is especially around Secretary Clinton's tenure as Secretary of State. Whether people were given special access. And that's sort of what some of the emails that came out today, I don't see any real explicit corruption there. What I see is a sort of sloppy commingling of the foundation world and the State Department world that I think everyone would have preferred was kept distinctly separate.
Well, but that's not to say that the U.S. government has, for decades, perhaps even for centuries, been about repaying favor to big donors. I mean, we have in the State Department, you have that whole tradition of political appointees, you know.
Right.
Who,
most
of
ambassadors.
Whom, exactly. Most ambassadors are just big donors. You know, the Secretary of Commerce is the guy that raises the most money for the campaign. You know, that's always been going on forever. So I don't know where the line is here.
Right. And in a sense, a high percentage of diplomacy is networking among well-connected, powerful, often wealthy, and business interests. mean, that's a pretty big component of what diplomacy is. So I think it would be naive to say, oh, it's so unseemly when the Secretary of State is associated with wealthy people and interests. I think that some of that isn't inherent in the job. And so when I look at these emails, I think the question one always has to ask themselves is this the kind of access that would have been there anyway, or is it, in fact, a special kind of access? And that's always tough to distinguish because, you know, is this person being given a meeting with the secretary because they were a donor, or are they a donor because they're friends for 20 years? And so that's the difficult thing to distinguish, I think.
Right, but the hard part now, because it's grist for the campaign mill, today the Trump campaign came out with a statement saying that the Clinton Foundation is the most corrupt entity in the history of American politics, or something along those lines. I mean, you know, just extraordinary hyperbole. And then you have to say, well, okay, and do you think it's okay for the Koch brothers to have these annual meetings that are highly secretive with massive security, where groups of billionaires meet and they put up $1 billion to defeat Hillary Clinton a couple of years back at a secret meeting in Newport Beach?
Right.
They operate in secrecy. I just don't understand the consistency here. So I guess, am I just complaining about the fact that this is an election season and this is all about partisan politics, or?
Well, I share your concern about very wealthy people, including the Koch brothers, being able to put together a secret political mission to try to influence the election. But I think I see an even greater parallel here in terms of conflict of interest and the presidency, with questions around Donald Trump's commercial enterprises. So if Trump wins the election, we don't really know what's going to happen to his massive businesses and commercial enterprises, whether they're worth as much money as he claims or not. The conflict of interest laws that say you're not allowed to run a business or be on a board if you're in government service, they don't actually apply to the president or the vice president. And so that loophole leaves a huge set of questions around what it would mean for Donald Trump presidency, especially when his business interests were designed around his personal brand. So it's like the opposite of something that you can easily divest or put in a blind trust. I mean, if the nature of your business is to put your name on a building, 40-foot tall sign in gold, how can you possibly divest yourself from it? So that to me is the parallel concern about Donald Trump, about conflicts of interest that he would bring to the presidency.
So you foresee pink marble and gold and in the White House, maybe the Trump White House.
It's possible. Well, I mean, if it was the concern, I guess the parallel concern would be not only that he does it, but that he pays his own business to manage it, and who knows what else.
Right. Well, it was certainly a good business card to have.
Right.
As a White House, 1600 Pennsylvania. Drop by the Oval Office and let's make a deal. Well, thank you very much for joining us. I appreciate it, John Wunderlich.
Sure. My pleasure.
And again, I've been speaking with John Wunderlich, who's the executive director for the Sunlight Foundation and one of the nation's foremost advocates for open government, one of the foremost authorities on transparency policy, from legislation and accountability in Congress to ethics and information policy in the executive branch. He has spoken internationally on technology and transparency and has testified before the Senate Homeland Security and Government Affairs Committee. We can take a brief station break and back with an analysis of the rebooted Trump campaign, now headed by Stephen Bannon, the chairman of Breitbart Media. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Sarah Posner, who's an investigative journalist, author, and expert on the intersection of religion and politics. She's the author of God's Prophets, that's P-R-O-F-I-T-S, Faith, Fraud, and the Republican Crusade for Value Voters. And she has an article at Mother Jones, How Donald Trump's New Campaign Chief Created an Online Haven for White Nationalists. Welcome to Background Briefing, Sarah Posner.
Thanks for having me, Ian.
And this relatively new reboot of the Trump campaign does appear to be at least showing signs of at least containing the candidate and scripting him. The first evidence was the speech he gave in Milwaukee, which is actually a very well-crafted, very clever speech, I thought. Apparently, there was a meeting a week ago on Sunday where Bannon and Kellyanne Conway and Roger Ailes was there, along with a few of the other insiders, the family, I guess. They plotted out this new strategy. And so far, from what I can tell, it looks like it's Kellyanne Conway who's having the influence, providing the adult supervision. I don't see any evidence yet of crazy right-wing bomb throwing, which is what one would associate Stephen Bannon with.
Well, I think that there's a reason for Trump having both Bannon and Conway on board. Conway is very well known to movement conservatives and particularly to the Christian right. She's known and trusted. And Bannon is very well known to what's known as the alt-right, which is the movement that very much supports Trump, disdains movement conservatism, and has contributed a lot to the culture, particularly online, in support of Trump from people who are anti-Muslim, anti-immigrant, and in many cases, white nationalists. So I think he's trying to play two games. One is to appeal to base Republicans and possibly independents by hiring Conway to give him that sort of advice, yet also keeping another foot in this other camp, which has very much fueled his campaign and animated his campaign.
So the fact that the campaign spending so far by Trump's, which is way below Hillary Clinton's, virtually nothing on television, he's spending quite a bit of money on online media. Is that to do with Bannon's side of the campaign? Are they very active? In other words, the Breitbart world, is it fired up? Is it reaching out? And what would its parameters be? I mean, I guess that's... Go ahead.
Yeah. The Breitbart world and the online world of the alt-right has been fired up about Trump since day one, basically since last June in 2015 when he announced his presidential candidacy and talked about Mexicans being rapists and wanting to build a wall and so on and so forth. So I don't think that Trump needs to do anything in particular or spend any – the campaign doesn't need to spend any money to fire up those kinds of supporters. They've been on board throughout his campaign. They supported him unquestioningly throughout the primary process. So it's not like it specifically requires the campaign to do a particular kind of outreach, unlike, I think, the outreach that the campaign feels like it might have to do to some other more traditionally Republican constituencies who have been more skeptical about Trump.
In other words, what Kellyanne Conway is doing now.
Her fingerprints were on his statement. I think it was on Saturday. It was some point over the weekend. He had a rally, and he talked about having regret for some things that he had said, even though he didn't really specify what he had regret about. And I think that was reportedly it was Conway who had convinced him to include that language. It's the sort of language that would be aimed at appealing to possibly skeptical evangelicals or religious voters who might be concerned about inflammatory things that Trump has said and wanting to see some kind of remorse or in his word, regret. Although I don't know that that worked that well because he wasn't very specific about what he was
regretful about. And he didn't use, you know, notably, he did not use the word repentant. You know, regret is very different from repenting. So I don't know if that really played to the what I would call the conservative never Trump crowd. But I think that this dual hire is aimed at Trump kind of having it both ways with these different aspects of the conservative base.
And again, I'm speaking with Sarah Posner, who's an investigative journalist, author, and expert on the intersection of religion and politics. She's the author of God's Prophets, that's P-R-O-F-I-T-S, Faith, Fraud, and the Republican Crusade for Value Voters, and her article at Mother Jones. And she has an article at Mother Jones, How Donald Trump's New Campaign Chief Created an Online Haven for White Nationalists. Let's go to that to understand Bannon and the alt-right. Which he considers himself a sort of champion, if not the kind of lightning rod for, which would, I think, is what Breitbart News is, the platform for the alt-right, which is what he boasted to you when you interviewed him, Sarah Posner, at the Republican National Convention. He claims credit, actually, for fomenting this populist nationalist movement long before Trump came on the scene and galvanized it.
He does. And, you know, obviously the alt-right existed before Trump announced his candidacy. But I think Trump's candidacy, in turn, made the alt-right more visible to people outside the alt-right world. Because I think the alt-right was there and it was agitating. And I think it was seeking to provoke the conservative movement and provoke the Republican Party. But I think that without Trump, it would not have had the kind of visibility that he's given it over the course of this campaign. I think that Bannon's right, that the movement existed before Trump. I think that people would dispute whether, you know, Breitbart was the sole purveyor of it or the single platform for it. I mean, but he was, you know, he was being, he was tooting his own horn, saying that, you know, his films that he's made and his overseeing Breitbart has fomented this national, he calls it a nationalist movement, a populist nationalist movement. He denies that it's a white nationalist movement. But, you know, obviously there have been other players. But Breitbart does have a very big platform, big traffic, a lot of followers, a lot of readers. It's the online presence. It's also, he has a radio show on XM Sirius. So, you know, he's right in the sense that he does have a big platform. And, you know, honestly, in the type of coverage that they've provided has attracted a lot of alt-right readers. Their comment section is populated with people with alt-right views. So, you know, in one sense he was boasting, and in another sense he wasn't wrong, although I think it would be incorrect to say that Breitbart is the sole online platform for the alt-right.
Well, but it seems like that what they're doing here, you talk about the bifurcation of the campaign between Stephen Bannon getting the alt-right people. They're already on board. They've been on board from day one, but somehow keeping them in the tent. Because if the suggestions that came out today that in a meeting that Trump had with some Latino Republicans that he might moderate his views and not deport 11 million people and maybe not insist on building the wall and having Mexico pay for it, clearly, if any of that's true, then there would be a backlash. So it does seem that this is what they're doing. They're throwing racist, nationalist red meat through Breitbart and trying to win over the soccer mums with Kellyanne Conway.
Well, I think also, as you mentioned, you know, he did have a meeting with Latino leaders. But after that, it appeared that the campaign was not going to backtrack on its immigration stance. And I think that Trump even pulled out of giving a speech on immigration, which he was supposed to do this week, and has decided not to do. So I don't think that there's going to be any backtracking of Trump's original position on deporting 11 million undocumented immigrants or building the wall. So I think this is part of the way Trump has been running his campaign, where on the one hand he'll get a group of people together and say something, and drop a hint, perhaps, that he's going to change a controversial view, but then he never does, right? So, you know, he hasn't really backed, even though he has said on multiple occasions, or surrogates have said on multiple occasions, that he was going to alter the test for allowing Muslims in the country. He hasn't really done that. So I think that there's a lot of talking out of multiple sides of the campaign's mouth, so to speak, and I think that that's just another example of it. But I don't think that we're going to see, I mean, Trump built his campaign on that immigration stance. I don't think we're going to see much of a change there.
No, but what I'm sort of suggesting here is that you've got these really tacky people like Pamela Geller. She's a despicable person. There's no two ways about it. And this white nationalist leader, Richard Spencer, is another one of the alt-rights, they call him dangerously bright, intellectual core, as you've written. You've got this crowd on the one hand, and then you've got Trump. Apparently, it could also be Roger Ailes who's advising him as well, but we'll just assume that it's Kellyanne Conway who's behind this new tone of speeches where he's reaching out to African-American voters and trying to appear to be inclusive. Obviously, that it's a complete chimera to think that African-Americans are going to vote for him. But the tone, and given that it was given to a white audience in a white suburb 45 miles away from where the unrest had taken place in Milwaukee, indicates to me that all of this stuff is meant to tell Trump's speakers, to tell Trump's constituents, oh, you're not really racists.
Right.
And they feel good about that. I mean, everything about this campaign is despicable in as much as he is a despicable human being. He's made it very clear who he is. Yet these Republicans, all up and down, from the top people like Ryan and McConnell, all the way down to, you know, the dog catchers, they basically are making excuses for him. They're even saying things like, we've got to vote for this guy because of the Supreme Court. In other words, you'd have a reckless and dangerous and perhaps unstable person in the White House. That's okay, is because you'll get right-wing judges on the Supreme Court. There's nothing that they're saying makes any kind of moral and intellectual sense. And then you watch this footage of him down in Louisiana, where for literally under 1 minute, him and Pence unloaded Play-Doh from the back of a truck. They only did 1 minute's worth of work, and that was enough, as far as these people are concerned, to show that he's moderating his stance and acting more presidential. I just want to scream. I just cannot understand how people don't see through this cynicism of this campaign.
Well, it's been that way throughout, pretty much since the time that he clinched the nomination. You know, you would see, oh, he's coming to D.C. to meet with Republican elected officials, and they're going to talk to him about moderating his stances or being more professional or running his campaign more professionally or what have you. And so you'll periodically have these meetings or a speech that he gives where he's supposedly reeling in some of his more inflammatory views or language. And, you know, he'll do it or even giving a speech from a teleprompter instead of ad-libbing like he often does, and he'll do it for, you know, a minute, and then he's back to the status quo. And this has been a pattern throughout, and you're right that, you know, the Republicans who are supporting him are being played because, you know, they look to these little nuggets that he'll give them, these little tidbits, where he's supposedly moderating his stance or becoming more professional, but he only does it very, very briefly, and then he goes back to his ways. You know, I mean, all it takes is somebody to give him his phone back and for him to tweet, and then it's obvious that nobody has any control of him whatsoever. So that's been pretty much the pattern for months now.
Well, I suppose just complaining or pointing out that Bannon's Breitbart when they cut loose their reporter, Michelle Fields, who was supposedly manhandled by Trump's then campaign manager, Corey Lewandowski, the fact that they, as a news organization, didn't stand by her, and Bannon made it clear to everybody that that they were slavishly going to support Trump and not and cut loose their own person, would be enough to tell anybody that this is not a news organization; it's a propaganda organization. And the same you can say for Fox, particularly with the sexual predator at the head of it, Roger Ailes. They've clearly proven themselves to be a propaganda, but what outfit and not a journalistic outfit. But amazingly, what's so extraordinary is that now there are some fairly credible rumors, if this, if you can use that phrase, credible credible rumors, that that maybe this is what Trump's angling for after November, with that Roger Ailes, the disgraced ex-Fox head, who's mad at Rupert because the boys forced him out and Rupert went along with it. And then, so he's ready to do something new, and you've got you've already got the Breitbart guys, Bannon on board, and that's what you're hearing, is that maybe they'll have an alt-right Fox News. But again, I still wonder how many Americans can live on a diet of rabid right-wing racism and be subject to Trump's tweets for 24/7.
I guess we might find out.
But so do you take that seriously? I mean,
I don't know. I mean, I do think that even if Trump isn't involved in it himself, I think that it's entirely, you know, we're probably going to see, even if he loses, I think we're probably going to see the creation of new media, Breitbart, spinoffs of Breitbart or imitators of Breitbart, who are going to continue to stoke this base. I mean, I think it's been a success in a way. I mean, it's been a commercial success apparently for Breitbart. And I think that you know, there's enough of a self-perpetuating following here that I think that they're going to want to continue to maintain that, whether Trump is involved in it explicitly or not after the election.
Well, Sarah Posner, I thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with Sarah Posner, who's an investigative journalist, author, and expert on the intersection of religion and politics. She is the author of God's Prophets, Faith, Fraud, and the Republican Crusade for Values Voters. And she has an article at Mother Jones, How Donald Trump's New Campaign Chief Created an Online Haven for White Nationalists. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can scroll down on the right-hand side to subscribe to iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.